The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
And where's the wireless mic? You got it? All right. And feel free to get up, wander over, get coffee, get drinks while we're talking. We know that we make people kind of dry in the mouth when they listen to us. So, without further ado. To American University of Washington College of Law. My name is John Superior. I'm the Vice President of the SBA here, and it's great to see all of you. First of all, I thank you guys for allowing me to open this very, very important event. It's really unique and unprecedented. I just make students involved in one student organization across the country on a Saturday morning, no less. I'm very proud to be part of it. I want to congratulate NSLS President Brad Mosher. I think he's done it for organizing this event. I want to congratulate former NSLS President and current national president, Kevin Cunningham, for everything he's done bringing NSLS into fruition in the first place. I want to extend my congratulations to everyone at Washington College of Law who has played a role in making NSLS what it is in a very short amount of time. And finally, and most importantly, I want to welcome everyone, all student delegates from across the country, to American University, Washington College of Law. It's great to have you guys here. Now, in all honesty, what you'll be crafting today is something that will be lasting for many generations of law students in the future. I'm sure you're well aware what you're doing here is extremely important. You're setting the groundwork, and it's going to last for quite some time. I do believe that. It's unfortunate that national security concerns are not going away, but that makes your job that much more important. Now, I'm sure I speak for many of you when I said I came to law school with interest in national security law already, and I was hoping that I'd find some way to meld my interest in the law with national security issues. And as you're well aware, not too many law schools really offer an opportunity for doing such a thing, which is why when I first heard of this proposal for a student group having something to do with national security and law, I had to sign up for the listserv right away, along with many, many other students. And it's, in all honesty, it's amazing in such a short amount of time how quickly NSLS has grown. It's one of our better-known student groups on campus. Many, many students are involved. And as you're well aware, it's an international organization with chapters throughout Canada as well. In fact, today we have 25 delegates from 16 different law schools. We have five schools who are not here in the process of chartering their own chapters as well. And I don't know if I was on your campus, but on our campus we've had all sorts of great opportunities because of NSLS. We've had job fairs that wouldn't have happened otherwise. We have panel discussions, which have been extremely interesting. The ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security has created three $500 scholarships for law students for next semester, which we're very happy about. We've had C-SPAN on two occasions now. The first was for Imminent 2005, which was a symposium of a variety of experts and panelists covering all sorts of topics of national security and the law. It was very, very interesting. We had 80 professionals attending. We had 32 panelists on a total of 8 different panels. And in all honesty, it makes sense that C-SPAN was here, because where else can you find this many experts talking about something that's so important, but really nowhere else? And that's what makes what you guys are doing here today that much more important. Our administrators are starting to see the importance of national security. We're starting to see more courses now offered in that field. And ultimately, the public's become better informed because of what you guys do here. So I just want to say that with everything NSLS has accomplished thus far, and with all the threats we continue to face, the future for society will undoubtedly be one of greatness and one of great importance. So thank you guys for being here today. I'm Kevin Cunningham, the past NSLS president, and as I mentioned before, the international president.
Well, thank you, John. I feel like I'm accepting an offer. John was really modest. He actually is on two of the committees that are very important to NSLS. He's running one of the panels for him in 2006, and he was one of the first people from his class to sign up. So we're very happy to have someone like him, especially on the SBA when we ask for money, to kind of vote in favor of us. This panel is not going to be your traditional panel discussion. And actually, I'm going to go ahead and give this mic to the people in the second row, because this is being podcast so that we can put it on our website and people from other chapters who couldn't come can listen to it, because I hope this panel will be very, you know, educational and informative for everyone involved, you know, now and in the future. It's not going to be us talking to you or at you. Each of us is going to talk for about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes about, you know, the type of things that we've done. With the exception of me, I'm actually going to be talking last because I'll be talking about how to deal with the administration and how to get loans or grants and stuff like that. And then the rest of the time is going to be kind of a give and take with y'all to say, you know, you have questions about how to run a publication. We have someone to do that. You have questions about how to run a web page. We have someone to do that. You have questions about how not to be a good law student. I'll take care of those. And, you know, so we want y'all to ask us anything and volunteer information. If you want to think of a great idea for a panel, you know, speak up. Say, you know, we were throwing this around and we were thinking about doing this. What do y'all think how would we go best about pulling this off? And you know, if we've done something similar, we'll tell you. If not, you're the expert. Maybe you can tell us. Anyway, I'm going to introduce my fellow panelists. As Brad said, unfortunately, two of us are running late, but they'll probably be here later. That's the representative from George Washington and Howard Universities. And to my right is Brad Moss. He's the president of the AU chapter. He's my co-founder. And he's basically taken over running everything this year and kind of setting the stage. And here's one of our latecomers right now.
Apologies. Got really bad direction. It was Kelly.
He'll be talking about the type of events that we have run here, or some of them. I'll be talking about actually the national scope events like the Eminent Conference and stuff like that. We have Brian Cruz here, who's the vice president of George Washington University's chapter, a chapter which, for being one of the youngest chapters, has in its first semester put on more events than we did in our first year in like the last month and a half.
Sorry.
Yeah. Which is amazingly remarkable, especially since, you know, they're making better grades than we did. To my further right is Josh Neely. He is the vice president of the University of Iowa chapter, one of the first chapters to sign up after we went national. And he'll be talking primarily about the things they've done and the National Security Law blog project that they came up with and are hoping to spread to other chapters to make kind of a network of blogs. And to my far right is Ms. Kate Mitchell. Not McAuliffe. There are two Kates on our editorial committee, sorry. Kate is one of the editors-in-chief of the proceedings of our Eminent 2005 conference, which will be published in bookstores in about a month for all y'all that are interested. You should get your library to buy a copy. They'll be very cheap. And she's going to be talking about and fielding questions about, you know, how to do a publication, how to deal with reluctant contributors and publishers and everything like that. But I'm done talking for now. I'll let Brad take it from here, and then I'll wrap up the end.
Thank you, Cal. I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Again, my name is Brad Moss. I'm the current chapter president here at WCL, and I'm the co-creator of this entire smorgasbord of societies. What I'm going to do real quickly, because Kelly mentioned he's going to discuss the kind of event ideas with a more national and multi-chapter scope. I'm going to simply discuss three templates, for lack of a better word, of kinds of events you can hold at your individual chapter that you don't necessarily need another school, another chapter to be involved in. Three templates, and you can interchange them or you can modify them however it suits your chapter, is the idea of a panel, a primer, and a practitioner center. The panel discussion is usually pretty simple. It works along these lines. Is you want, usually, because this is a nonpartisan organization, and because you generally want to make the issue something that will draw a decent audience. If you make it too boring or simply educational, you're not going to get law students to show up. Law students think about three things and three things only. They think about their grades, they think about journal or moot court, whichever one they're on, and they think about jobs. And that's about it. So you got to make it something interesting enough to make them leave the library to show up. So the panel discussion, generally, what we've used as our template for it was you generally wanted someone from a government perspective to discuss however the government's facing the problem, whether it be A panel that, for instance, the WCL chapter is doing in the spring is investment in international investment and national security. Thinking about, you know, with the UNICEL issue that came up recently and the national security exemptions that exist in a lot of the international investment treaties, how this plays into these various different perspectives, whether it be the governmental perspective, private industry, who's obviously going to be dealing with it a lot because they're the ones the business is trying to get the investment, or from the academic or purely legal perspective, whether it be simply a professor speaking on from a more general philosophical aspect, or someone who's a practitioner who may be involved in the lawsuits. When you are marketing these kind of events, you want to consider who your audience is, because your audience is either A, going to be law students, or B, going to be professionals. If it's law students, marketing is usually pretty simple. Pretty much every law school has some kind of newsletter that goes out about once a week. Basically, you'd want to advertise it at least 2 weeks in advance for those two, both whatever it be. If it's once a week, you want to do it 2 weeks in advance and then the week before, and you usually get a pretty decent crowd. If it's professionals, you generally want to coordinate with, we have at WCL what's called the Office of Special Events. At other schools, it might be called something differently, but you definitely want to use your school's bureaucracy to market it to professionals. They have a host of connections to every single ABA, not an NGO, and everything you can think of, and press, excuse me, to market it so they get professionals to become aware of it. We're all very resourceful and aggressive, as you can see by the fact that you're here, but we are still law students. We're still limited in terms of who we know. So you want to use your bureaucracies as much as you can and let them take the load off you on some of that aspect. Second template is the simple idea of a primer discussion. Primers are basically if you have a very general topic that you know people might be interested in, but they don't really want to take a course in it. For instance, we've done one very basic on national security law and foreign policy and public diplomacy, or the law of leaks, where basically it's just one speaker coming in and giving about an hour discussion, an hour worth of remarks, giving basically taking what would normally be an entire course load over an entire semester and giving that whole entire speech in an hour, giving you just the basic outlines and guidelines of it. And it gives the students, maybe 20 students normally show up for this kind of thing, just an idea to get a basic understanding of it. It allows for both your members and the rest of the school to learn just basic guidelines of what they might know and what might want to know, and it gets them a chance to get interested in the idea. Third template is quite simply what we always call the practitioner's dinner. And what we have done, what we found success with, is the idea of getting one professional in the field, someone fairly, not necessarily fairly well known, but fairly renowned and experienced. We've had a former ambassador, we've had the gentleman who was the CIA, was it CIA liaison? Or yes, CIA liaison to the 9/11 commission. And again, use your bureaucracies, use your Office of Alumni Relations to help potentially get some of these speakers. They will, that's their job, that's what they're getting paid for while we're going broke with loans. But use them to get some of these speakers. But it's generally an idea of a small, intimate dinner, maybe 15 students and faculty, and you let them explain to you their war stories. Let them say, here's how I came up in the national security field, or national security, homeland security, whatever it is. Here's what I've experienced. And it gives both the students a chance to hear the war stories, hear how they came up in a very intimate, you know, dinner-style gathering, and it gives them a chance to ask questions of these individuals. With that being said, I'm going to stop talking because I've talked my 3 minutes. I'm going to give it over to the gentleman from GW, and hopefully the gentleman from Howard will show up soon. We put on a whole lot of events, so I don't want to just start listing off events we've done. I'm going to let the gentleman from the younger chapters give you more of the information on what they have put on at the moment. So with that, I give it over to you.
Great. So I'm not gonna go over what they already talked about. I'll be more brief and then give questions. Great. First off, I would like to just premise by saying people in the field love to talk about what they do. Like, they really do. Just give them an excuse to. Like, if you ever go to, like, a meet and greet or, like, a resume dump or whatever, just, like, say, hey, we're doing this thing. Would you like to speak? Have your card? And they'll be like, great, because lawyers love to talk. Yes. So don't be hesitant to ask people to come speak. They're more than likely going to say yes. And if not, they'll say, oh, I can't, but I'd like in the future, just please contact me if you have anything available. Another thing we do like to do as well is to start off our weekly or monthly meetings, we'll get a practitioner, a local one, to maybe speak 10 or 15 minutes just in general, just to get people to come to the meeting, make sure there's a higher turnout, and then they just give a little speech, what they've done, a little question and answer, and then we proceed to the general meeting. It's a good segue, it's a good way to get people to come to the general meeting and find out what it's all about. That being said, some of the things we've done this semester, because this is our first semester, we had a panel on intelligence law and privacy, and basically with the Patriot Act and the revamped laws following 9/11. And we had a couple professors that dealt specialized in privacy law and computer crimes and that type of thing. And we had a speaker from the DOJ Cybercrime Division and an FBI lawyer that dealt in cybercrimes. And it was, was moderated by another professor, and then they went back and forth, and it was fun to watch professors go at it with the practitioners, because they generally have opposing views on whether or not we should be allowed to impinge upon privacy, shocking enough. And then we actually have, for everyone that's actually going to be here on Monday, we have another panel coming up, which is going to be on government contracts and outsourcing in the war on terror. And following 9/11, the Pentagon outsources so much more now than they used to in terms of what was traditionally thought as military work, and just issues of like private security and supplies and that type of thing is done by private contractors mostly now. So we're going to have a couple professors that specialize in government contracts, one of which is also a JAG reserve officer, and we're going to have a DOJ lawyer that does a lot of liaison work with government contractors, and then we're going to actually, which is really exciting, we're going to have the head counsel and VP of Triple Canopy, which is one of the private security firms. They're over in Iraq, they're in Afghanistan, so they're going to come and give perspective on why it's actually good that they get to basically be really, I mean, to some extent, it's basically legalized mercenary work, but they don't call it that, they call it private security. So they're going to be talking. And then some other things we have practitioners that are coming up. One is going to be with the former senior head of the House Armed Services Committee, and he's going to have a private practitioner center with us with like 10 people and discuss things in the field. Beyond that, honestly, the best way to, like, especially if you're going to be new, don't be afraid to do joint panels or joint events with other groups that are already established that might have a better network or might be more likely to just bring people in, even if they don't know about the topic in particular, just because they've known that these people have given good events before. Don't be afraid of that. The only thing I'd hesitate is don't get involved in partisan groups. Like, don't do something with the Federal Society or ACU or the Republicans or the Democrats, because you want to remain nonpartisan to be able to not inherently exclude half of the law school from wanting to be involved in one of your events. Don't be afraid to do with subject matter groups that may lean certain ways, like we're going to do a joint event with the ACLU. Clearly, they're going to probably lean a little to the left on issues, but it's not inherently partisan. And you just don't want to look like you're a political group that you have a cause, because we don't. We're just trying to, it's supposed to be networking, it's supposed to be informative, and it's not supposed to be pushing an agenda. So try to avoid groups that do that. And with that, I'll probably turn it over, because I feel that I talk too much.
Okay, as a new chapter, and I guess also one in the Midwest where we don't have a whole lot of ready-made national security practitioners, first, the speakers that we recently set up our chapter, and we've set up a number of speakers, either alumni or people that our professors know very well, and I would say utilize those resources as much as possible. And especially if you are in an area where not a lot of people even know anything about. And so, first of all, we have one speaker coming out in a couple of weeks. We'll be our first actual speaker, and Ryan Stiles. Then in February, which is kind of our keynote for the year, we have John Yu coming in, who he was our sponsor faculty member, was a student and researcher of John Yu's. And so we have him coming in, which I'm very excited about, and we're going to really press the advertisement for that. But so utilize those resources as much as possible. Your professors always know somebody. Then moving on to, we do have a blog project that we're working on currently, and most people know what a blog is, but basically it's a journal on the internet. Something like a bulletin board, but a little more organized. I can't give the address right now because I learned from the time that I left to come here until now that it's no longer up and running at the moment. But we'll post that out as soon as we get it back online. But basically, the purpose of it is to have a forum for both ideas and news and events and such, arguments, and just someone wanting to speak on a topic or write on a topic. You have to, if we do kind of, we do intend to have links to other chapters who would like to set up a blog as well. And I guess one, if you're interested in doing so, one thing, if you use your school, university's web space that some provide, often you have to pay attention to their rules, and we don't want anybody getting in trouble for violations of that. I know our university, in order to give web space, we can't have a bulletin board type setting, so we have to have it more regulated. We have to have somebody, whenever, if someone wants to post, it has to go through an intermediary. But that's kind of the idea, is that if you want to post an article, you would send it to the secretary, the editor, whoever would have that duty in your chapter, and then they would post it and go through making sure it's appropriate for the chapter. I guess if anybody has any questions on that issue, I'd be open for them. There's not a whole lot of just pure statement I can make on the issue.
Well, like has been said, I'm one of the editors in charge of the proceedings that we're doing for our recent Eminent event. And it's actually the first publication that we're putting out, and with that we learned a lot of very important lessons. First being, it is a much bigger project than you would anticipate at first. So it's really important to start early and to be incredibly organized. What we're basically doing is collecting essays from each of the panelists that we had at Eminent on the topic that they talked about on their panel, and we're publishing it together as a series. And what we found is that the authors, A, are not very good about getting us their papers, and B, not very good about writing quality papers. As any of you on Journal might know, sometimes scholars in the field are not exactly the best writers in the field. So it takes a lot of work, and it's important to get a lot of people involved. The way we've set it up, which has actually worked out very well, and I'd recommend it, is that we've split up the responsibilities into basically three parts. There's three of us main editors. One person has been handling the publisher, getting in contact with the company, sending in stuff, getting the estimates, and then they're more responsible for going back to the SBA and saying how much, you know, we're going to need to publish it. One person is in charge of getting to the authors, trying to nicely hound them and get them to get their papers in without using threats, hopefully, but if it comes to that. And then one person is in charge of the bulk of the editing and getting together a committee of, an editing committee of mostly 1Ls and 2Ls, because they're usually, that's the way to get into the committee, of doing the editing, going through the papers. We're putting everything through three rounds, so by the time it gets to the top, hopefully it's of publishable quality. what was I going to say? So I guess basically you want to get together early. You want to figure out how many speakers you have, what kind of length your papers are going to be, so how long the proceedings are going to be, and then you're going to want to find a publisher. What we've done, which worked well, is we went to the journals at our school and found out who they used, and then we went and we asked them and gave them some of the specifics, and we got a pretty good deal, and that was pretty much the easiest way to go and how I'd recommend it, because they're probably going to give you a really good price because the journals wouldn't be using them if they didn't, and you already know them. Somebody else in the school probably have some kind of a relationship with them, so if you're having a hard time, you can go through them. And then you got to start early getting the papers. This year, we've had people handing in the papers after the event. What we would recommend in the future is making it very clear at the outset, when you invite them to come to the panel, that a paper is expected and hopefully given at the time of the panel, because then you don't have to worry about going after. A lot of people said, well, I didn't know I was going to have to write a paper and I don't want to do it. So then we had to actually go back and use transcripts of the panel and try to make it into an essay, which actually is a very good threat, though, because if you tell them you're going to use their transcript, if they don't send in a paper, some of them are a little bit weirded out by that, so they're going to send a paper. And then getting your editing committee together early on is very important because, you know, right now it's towards the end of the semester and, you know, people have their classes, they're getting ready for exams, they have papers. They don't want to be editing papers, you know, for hours on end. So the earlier you get it done, the better. So basically just, I would say, get together early, get a good group of people. It's not something that one or two people can do on their own, and then delegate authority. And hopefully you'll have, like, the three of us, we work very well together, you know, and just try to work hard.
All right, well, it comes around to me again. Yay. First of all, I want to thank all of these panelists for sitting up here and standing in the spotlight and talking about this stuff. This society, if it's going to work, is going to be a bottom-up society. And that means that, you know, the international office is going to be there to coordinate. It's going to be there to provide resources. But each of the chapters is really going to be on their own. And, you know, they can succeed beyond their wildest dreams. They can. We'll try and help them not fail or succeed if they want our help. But, you know, everything with the for the vast majority of projects, it is going to be tailored to each specific school. There are a couple of things, though, that because of their scope, you know, I mean, and this is the way the Constitution that I wrote at like 3 o'clock in the morning is written, that may be changed this afternoon, that, you know, we would want to take a more, and by we, I mean, you know, the overseers, the umbrella international office, would want to take a more active role in. And this is actually good for y'all, good for the chapters, because some of them are just, you know, beyond the ability of most chapters to do. That would be things like the imminent conference. We want this to be a completely egalitarian organization. And so while for the next couple of years, because we already have the established infrastructure, we're going to host Eminent here at AU. We want, you know, Nova Southeastern to host it 1 year, and, you know, Ottawa to host it another year, and have it move around the way, you know, the conventions do, the Phi Alpha Delta Convention, the ABA Convention, have it in a different city each year, because each conference will then have its own flavor of, you know, what the area is like, what the interests are in that field. So we're wanting to help with that. This last conference, most of y'all have been to the website, most of y'all have read about it, read the schedule, heard me like send multiple emails about how wonderful it was and everything, and, you know, it was on C-SPAN. That in itself should be something. It's very interesting. On a note on the publication for that, we're not really sure, and this will be up to y'all and the other members, how the proceedings are going to work in the future, because some schools, you know, may be able to host a minute, but may not have anything close to the resources to throw together a publication. And so we might try and make that more of an international project. Say, you know, the school hosts it, but, you know, an editorial committee comprised of people from different schools actually runs the proceedings. We don't know how that's going to work yet. I'm not going to beat the proceedings and the Eminent to death, though, because we're going to be discussing that this afternoon. The other thing, and this is actually more of a local thing, but it possibly will, especially with some of the smaller schools or schools in, you know, not Washington, D.C., where they're not easily accessible to 10,000 recruiters, an inter-school event, but it's something that y'all will probably want to do, if not have to do, depending on the Constitution, is the career event. Now here, because we're in Washington, you know, we can go and get, you know, 10 recruiters to come to a national security career fair. And that is amazing, first of all, because most schools, their OCS, I can say that, you know, our OCS really hates national security. This is a very liberal school. And so, but the students love it. And so when we put together a career fair and have people from NSA and DHS and CIA here, you have people lined up around the corner to go to the tables. You'd be amazed at this. And sometimes it's really cool. Occasionally you'll have a career fair like we did last year, where the OCF was like, oh, how nice. No, you go host your little fair. And then they saw the results, and they came to us wanting to know who our contacts were in the agencies so that they can integrate it into their process. And that's, okay, so we don't get as much credit for it the next year, but, it's good for the students because they have more power than we do as far as, strong-arming people to come. And cooperative career fairs work wonders. We had an arrangement with Catholic University the first year that unfortunately nobody is here from them today. But when we were a local chapter, and they're actually the oldest national security student organization in the country. And they were formed 5 years ago, something like that. And we entered into a cooperative arrangement with them where basically we hosted a career fair in the fall and they hosted one in the spring. And our students went to theirs and their students went to ours. This year we had people from GW, from Howard, from Catholic, George Mason, everybody came to the career fair. Wake Forest, somebody came up from Wake Forest to go to our career fair, which was really cool. And, not only is it a career-related event, but, hey, you get to meet people from your neighboring chapters. And it's a little mini networking thing between the students, even if none of them get the jobs. And most of them do get jobs. Well, I can think of several people who got jobs from the career fair that we had here. I was one of them. I got a job at the Homeland Security because of the career fair. Department of Homeland Security, sorry. Because some schools don't have that, though, they can't get four recruiters. You can't get two recruiters together if they're in Iowa. There are no recruiters in Iowa. Actually, there are. But they're not enough to have a real career fair. Or maybe there's not enough interest to have a real career fair. Have a career event. Part of it, we actually incorporated it into our last career fair. We had two events in one day. We had a CIA recruiter come in and talk for an hour and give a little recruiting pitch on why you should join the Director of Operations. And then we had the main career fair. Just have little events like that. There's always a district office of the FBI, or Booz Allen has an office in a nearby city, something like that. They'd be happy to come by and get law students. People love law students because it's a very analytical set. And on that note, I'll stop and open it up for questions. I will make one addendum to that is we are a very broad scope organization. And that is the way it's really meant to be. If your school is a primarily, human rights school, cover human rights things. We have our friend from Howard, who's not here, they're a very military-oriented school. And so almost all of their events are military. But, we've done events on, secrecy. We've done events on environmental climate change and a threat to security. You'd be amazed what you can cover with the umbrella of national security. And similarly, they also have different career interests. Don't just cater your career events to people who want to be lawyers, because you'll find that probably a good 30 or 40% of your members want to use their law degree in a kind of non-traditional form and go work on the Hill, go be an analyst in the CIA or something like that. And especially if you have a JDMA program or something like that. That being said, I want y'all to talk. So I will ask that because we are podcasting this, I mentioned this before, the microphones, try and speak, towards it as best you can. There's a wireless mic on the second row for those of y'all who couldn't sit up front. And questions, opinions. If y'all have an event that you put together, your event you want to put together, something like that, I especially like to hear from the people from UVA because they have an entire center that does things even before the student organization existed, so I'm sure they have some great ideas of things to do.
Please introduce yourself.
And rather than have everyone go around and say, hi, I'm Kelly McClanahan, I'm from American University, I figure that, you know, if you do have, all of y'all will probably be speaking by the end of the day. So, you know, say hi. Here I am, who I am. Here's my question. So, first, anyone, anyone?
Okay, maybe Booz Allen is...
There are a lot of alcoholics now.
Booz Allen is... And, yeah, even though you... Yeah, I don't need a mic either. But in order to pick up on the recorder for the podcast, you need to pick a mic. That's why we pass it around. Booz Allen is one of the leading, especially in D.C. and, like, New York, one of the leading defense and intelligence contracting firms. And I'm sure that their name will come up on Monday, because... I think they have consultants in every intelligence agency. It's amazing that they got their fingers in every pie. And their website is bah.com. Also, is it BoozAllen.com or BoozAllenHamilton.com? BoozAllen.com. And they love law students and they love people with advanced education. And so I think, just as a personal note, apply for jobs there because they pay really well, which is very cool.
And they're located nationally?
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere.
California, Europe.
Iraq.
New York, D.C. They have various regional offices.
Yeah.
I know you guys got questions regarding budgeting, regarding all the various administrative pieces that you're scratching your heads going, I have no idea. Please feel free.
I actually do have another question.
Oh, sure.
I'm from Case School of Law in Cleveland, and we were just authorized. We don't even really, we haven't had any meetings and anything. I was point man on this pretty much. And so I've been speaking to a few others that went to the event yesterday for the ABA annual review of the field. And one of the things that I was maybe going to throw out there as far as structure of our exec committee and just, I guess, the whole organization, would you suggest, and this is a question for anybody who already has established charter or chapter, having maybe committees for each kind of area or field of national security to maybe operate and work on getting in speakers or career events?
And I'll take that first. That's actually kind of a neat idea that we hadn't thought of. We split our committees by project. Like there's a symposium committee, there's a marketing committee, a membership committee, editors committee, and that's actually a pretty cool idea, I think, is your approach, because thing is, the committee won't have much to do, because you know you may go a year without an immigration event, and so you may not. So you might want to do what kind of the LAs do on the Hill, legislative assistance, sorry. I sound like someone from D.C. And, you know, if you go to a senator's staff, you'll see the legislative assistant. One person will cover housing, veterans affairs, homeland security, interior, fishing. If you have committees, have kind of, you know, legislative-style committees that you have, you know, 12 issues in each committee, and then that will be the committee that you go to for anything related to that. I can like that. I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, I was just going to say, especially starting up, I would be less concerned with that and more concerned with getting your general structure, your chapter working. I know the way we did it starting off was we just decided what 4 panels we wanted for the year. And once we got the topics down, then we delegated like people that work on those. But until you have a more established overall structure, don't worry about trying to delegate and micromanage that much. Be more concerned with just getting everyone involved and getting the groundwork laid. And then it comes to the point where you're so busy that you need to delegate to committees. That's more power to you. But I, especially as Kelly was saying, I can't see there being enough events and enough different areas that to warrant having that much subcontracting, essentially. You don't, for lack of a better word, like subcommittees. I can't see, unless you're gonna, as Kelly said, overlap and have multiple jurisdictions for various people. That just seems to me creating more bureaucracy than is necessary to get things done, and it might actually hinder your ability to work as effectively. But that's just me. I mean, again, individual chapters can structure how they feel is best for them, and you shouldn't look at us to like say this is how you have to do it, because we're idiots.
Actually, I was going to say just a quick thing on that. We, for instance, until our second year, didn't even have committees, because at the beginning, to go along with what these two gentlemen have said, beginning, you're very much looking for the basic structure. You're looking for people who you can truly rely on. You want to have a core group, could be as many as four or five people, who you know who, if you say, we need to get these people, I need you to do the phone call today, they won't go, well, I don't feel like doing it today, I'm going to go study for, you know, property. You want to have a core group of people who will commit to do some of this work. So at the beginning, I would worry more about that than just like committees. Next question.
Hi, Gabriel Sapir from Hofstra in New York. When we get chartered, we're not chartered yet, but when we do, our school has a rule that we're only allowed actually $250 for the first year.
Wow.
So.
Are you allowed ad hoc funding, or is that your budget completely?
That's our budget completely. That's for all organizations that start out. Every organization is on a provisional basis for their first year.
Is that
and
fundraising? Are you allowed to fundraise on your own at all, or no?
I don't see why we can't.
Because most of the money we get is through our own fundraising.
Really? Okay. So in terms of...
We did Halloween grams. Like you get little, like,
yes,
messages,
right.
Halloween candy. Like,
right. Okay. I've seen other organizations do that.
Raise money.
But in terms of our limited funding, for the first year at least. And then at the end of the year, we have to go in front of our student bar and say, this is what we've done. This is why we deserve more funding. So my question was, in terms of like speakers, do you guys have to, when you actually get the speakers, is there a, do you have to pay them, or how does that work?
No, we do not give honoraria or anything.
We're not actually allowed to by the school.
Yeah, our school won't. I'm sure.
We're not allowed. The school will not fund gifts, so or pay for anyway. I mean, we're giving them little mugs if they National Security Law Society, but it's out of our pocket. We can't. The school. So don't worry about using money to pay for it. Speakers come because they want to speak and they like being in front of people, and it's a good recruitment tool. You don't have to pay them. Don't worry about that.
Right.
And also, I'll say to add to that, as long as your budget is that limited for the moment, for you guys, you probably definitely want to focus on whatever New York area speakers you can find. But once you get, this goes for people who don't have necessarily this restriction, we can at WCL, I don't know if GW has the same policy, we can bring in speakers when we submit our budget. If they're coming from Washington State, if they're coming from Chicago, we can put in the budget the minimum airfare that we can get budget for them in a hotel, and that generally will get approved. So when you have more access to resources, that is something you can ask for if you have to get a speaker from outside of the area. But at the moment, yeah, you're going to have to run on the shoestring.
Okay.
And I'm kind of going to steal an idea from Brian. If we only had $250, we'd co-sponsor everything. Find someone who's been around for a year and, you know, say, with free labor, we'll do your marketing. We'll make the posters and stuff. You pay for it, and we'll help you get people. And you know, would the Immigration Law Society like to have the Commissioner of INS called? Our international president knows him. Something like that. So I mean, that you can always sell people on that.
Right. Do you guys have like the international committee? Would there be any sort of assistance in getting speakers or having contacts with?
Oh yeah, that's what we're here for.
Okay, because that I think for me at our school at least, I'm not sure exactly how strong our alumni is in this field, and I spoke to some professors and they said, yeah, you know, I'll try, but you know, I'm not guaranteeing anything, you know, and I kind of want to focus more on, you know, the professor said, you know, if you can't find any speakers, you know, try to do state instead of a federal. And I kind of want to focus more on the federal side, but if I could turn to you guys for some contacts in terms of field offices in New York or...
Well, international president.
International president, yes. I am the international office until 5 o'clock today. That's why we're national. International. I keep forgetting that. We want to do stuff like that, and it's not just us, because we're only going to be like eight people, four of whom are professionals. We do. I didn't mention it earlier today. This morning, Brad and I actually went to the Standing Committee on Law and National Security's meeting, and we have a very close relationship with them, and they have pretty much said, you need help, you need a speaker, let us know. If we got someone who lives near the area, we'll come by and we'll speak, or we'll help you get somebody. One of them is helping us get our keynote speaker for Eminent 2006, hopefully, Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the Valerie Plame case. And the other thing is, it's not just us. That's why the NSLS XCOM Yahoo group was set up, which all of y'all should be members of by now, after you got 10,000 emails from me about it. If you post on there, hi, we're looking to have an event in this, who knows anybody? Somebody from Case Western may say, oh yeah, my professor does this kind of thing. I'm sure he'll know somebody in the field. It's supposed to be a huge networking tool. Okay. That's all we want to do is just, be the web that ties all y'all together.
The other thing is, you don't need alumni contacts in order to get speakers, because I know a lot of government agencies, they just have systems set up where they just have speakers going. Like when we got the guy from DOJ Cybercrimes, we didn't know anyone there. I just contacted the Cybercrimes Division, the liaison for external speakers, and said, this is what we want. They're like, okay, we'll get back to you in a week to see if we have anything. They did, and they gave us a speaker. That was the first contact we ever had with them. So they're often more than willing to give out speakers. Another way to do it is just, who else? I know the FBI has a liaison office for speakers. Even if you just go to career events and you just talk to the recruiters there, we have one of the recruiters from the AU career event that was earlier in the year is now going to be one of our guest lunch speakers, where it's going to be a brown bag lunch. So we met him there, and that was it. And we have no other contact with him. He's from ICE. We have no other contact with ICE. So, you don't have to go strictly through your alumni office. You don't have to have pre-existing contacts. The person from Triple Canopy that's coming, we just contacted Triple Canopy and said, we were having this panel, would you like to speak? And they liked you because it's good PR for them.
Right.
So don't be hesitant to just cold call or cold contact various agencies, because often they'll just agree to it because they like getting their name out. So.
Also, just to add to that, when you do make the initial call and they say we'll get back to you in a week, do not hesitate to follow up with them. It's a bureaucracy. They will forget, possibly. I'm glad to hear that they did call you back, but sometimes that they will forget, and you do have to remind them 14 times over.
Just one really short thing. One of the great things about the Department of Homeland Security being, everywhere is that they have a thing called Speakers Bureau, which is run by a lovely young lady named Heather Blanchard, who I annoyed for about weekly for a while. And, you call her up. She already has a relationship with us. You call her up and say, who from DHS can talk about border crossings or something? And they'll find somebody. And it may be a flunky, or it may be, the deputy director of the section. But a flunky's a flunky. It's better than what you got if you don't have a speaker at all. And once he comes to speak, he can say, well, I really like this group. Next time you can go ask him, I'm looking for somebody to do a senior panel on this. Could you give me a recommendation? We got a couple of our speakers that way by just, befriending, kissing up to the interns, the low-level staffers who, they love to talk about it because they're so proud that they're there. And they hope that if they get to speak, then that'll get them a promotion. It'll get them more image within their department. Josh?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the importance of co-sponsorship, especially if you don't have that many funds. At our university, we don't have that restriction. We can give honorariums even, which is nice. But I know we haven't had too much trouble getting initial money from the Student Government Association, but we are co-sponsoring a couple of events. with other groups. And we have we are co-sponsoring with some political organizations, but the ones we're doing ACS and Federal Society. And I think those are debates that we're doing. And those groups have access to generally a lot of funding as well.
Before we go on, one thing. We're from Toledo, and there are a lot of practitioners out that way, and a very easy way to get a speaker for a variety of subjects is just start tapping your own faculty. You're going to have somebody on your own faculty that teaches immigration. You're going to have someone who teaches international law, you know, criminal procedure. It all plays a role in the overall national security law, and they'll speak for free because professors just like to hear themselves talk. You know, and that's a really good way to just start a small organization. Last year, a criminal justice organization started at Toledo, and it was the first time they ever had one. And they did a lot of professors speaking at first just to get people to start showing up to the meeting so that they knew if they wanted to invite somebody bigger that they would come in like that.
Only thing I'll add to that is in terms of funding, and again, this comes down to each school's SBA. They might run it differently. At WCL, we have a slight issue if there is no outside speaker. If it's only a professor at the school, whether it be adjunct or full-time, they will not give you funding if you wanted to provide food. If you wanted to do just brownback lunch with the professor, that'd be fine, but you may run into that issue sometimes.
Actually, I'm going to put John on the spot.
Uh-oh.
And say, because he's the vice president of the SBA. How would y'all, that you being the big politico that you are, suggest, you know, people to get on the good side of their SBA when they're first trying to get established?
On the good side of the SBA. Well, again, every SBA is different. You know, we have our own guidelines and standards. I think one of the things that's most important is that you have something to show for yourself. You know, we have proposed student groups before us right now, and they are so general. I don't even know what they want to do. They want money, but, you know, what are you going to do with it? So, you know, we want to see that you have speakers, for one thing. We want to know what type of events you're going to have, do you have dates scheduled. The more organized you are, the better off it's going to be, which speaks to, you know, questions earlier. You know, depending on where you are in the process right now, you know, first things first, get organized. Let's see here. I'd also say, too, that the other thing is once you prove yourself once, you know, next time you come back, it'll be a little easier to get a little more funding. You know, we don't give out. Our funds are relatively limited. We have 50-something student groups right now, which is a pretty good number for the amount of money we have. And if you prove yourself once and you have enough students interested and you get your name out there, it's going to be easier to come back to us, you know, down the road for more money. I know we've had, you know, some problems. Again, the Senate changes every, you know, handful of months as it is. So, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion on how to run things. But we're actually in the process right now trying to really get the bylaws organized in terms of how student groups are funded and how we accept and recognize student groups. So it's going to depend on your own SBA. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's a great answer.
This is why we brought him. Actually, on funding, yeah, one thing. I actually wrote it into the Constitution as a requirement. You know, it may be taken out later, but even if it's not a requirement, the best way to get on the good side of your SBA for funding is if you have an event that you sell registrations to, like a CLE event or something, pay them back. We, as I said, we made scholarships with the profit. We actually paid the SBA back all the money that they gave us for the Eminent Symposium from our registration fees and stuff. And that was like $15,000, something like that. And, you know, so this year, you know, the budget process hasn't happened yet. But, you know, I don't think that there'll be a whole lot of debate on whether or not to give us that money again, because, you know, once you've established that you can get the draw and that, you know, it's a good investment, then they'll love to do stuff like that because it makes the school look good. When the school looks good, the dean's happy, and when the dean's happy, the SBA president is less stressed out.
One thing I was going to add to that, for if and when you put on panel discussions in terms of kissing up to your SBA, if you have a panel discussion, you have a bunch of outside speakers, so you have someone from the government, industry perspective, all this. If you consider the fact you probably want to have a moderator, try to find someone on your faculty who is got expertise in that area. It looks a whole lot better when you go before the SBA and they go, it's being moderated by Professor So-and-so, who's a faculty member here, and here's the outside speakers. They like it a lot better when the school can show off the faculty members they have. It makes them feel happier.
And also let SBA members, like the president and vice president, greet people when the conference starts. That's always good.
All right.
In addition to being recognized, I'm Karen Berger from Pace University up in New York. In addition to being recognized by the SBA and so forth, which our school is fortunate because myself and the other individual who's looking to start the organization is on the SBA and are voting members, so it makes a difference.
That's also good.
So yeah, that's another way to get people on the SBA to approve you, is have people on the SBA involved. But in addition to that, what exactly are the steps that we need to go through to receive a charter?
From us?
Yes.
I'm practicing what I preach. I'm sort of going to dodge that question because that's part of the Constitution, and so that's kind of up in the air. Since it's probably not that controversial, I'll go ahead and say what's in there is that, you know, we're not, you know, we modeled our Constitution on that of the Federalist Society and Phi Alpha Delta, and there was a lot of language in the PAD Constitution that we just completely stripped out. Things like how you have to get approved, you have to petition to be a member, or to be a chartered organization, stuff like this. We don't want that. We want chapters everywhere. And so as far as it stands right now, if you go to the SBA and you get approved and you use our model constitution and bylaws for your chapter, you come to us and say, look, we're approved. We use your model constitution and bylaws, and unless you're like planning to bring terrorists to speak or something, we'll say welcome to the fold. I mean, we won't. I am completely politically incorrect here. I'm on a crusade. I want, you know, national security law to be taught in every school in the country, and the only way to do that is to get people aware of what's out there, and so. We don't want to stifle things. We only have unchartering removal of the charter. Basically, excommunication, where the international office would basically jerk a charter away from a chapter. We only have that in there because the people that we talked to, the professionals, said, you know, somewhere down the line, there's a chance that you might have a chapter that really screws up and then you're like open to liability, you're open to lawsuits and stuff. And for the ladies that came in, we have to put this on microphones if you could take these two seats up front.
You came in late, you have
to. So yeah, we want you to join. So there's nothing you have to do other than email us and say, hey, where do I sign up?
My name is Lex. I'm from Drake, so I feel your pain. I was going to ask, because I know that our Constitutional Society has hosted events where they've offered CLE credit, and it's gotten practitioners to come in. Does the ABA help with funding if you offer CLE credit, or no?
No. I'm taking this one because we actually just put on a seminar about a good 2 weeks ago. It was ethical issues for government lawyers. We offered not just CLE credits, but it was ethics CLE credits, which professionals will tell you are insane to get.
And Eminent has like 10 or 12 CLE credits.
General CLE credits. But no, ABA will not help you with the funding. That is very much, in terms of, you won't get extra funding for it, but what you can do is you can run it through whatever version of your school has an Office of Special Events where they will handle the registration aspect. They take it off your hands so you don't have to worry about taking in registration forms and running credit cards and things along those lines. They will set up a process probably on their website where the people can link to the website and you'll have it, whatever marketing aspects you do, you'll say for registration purposes go to this area, this link. But they'll have it so it's a simple form that the people will fill out and they'll provide their information of whatever state bar they're barred in. And that way, they can run all these processes for you, and you can simply say, okay, so how many people signed up yet?
And then who gets the money?
Initially, it depends on what ranger you have. We set it up because we set it up basically that the initial costs were borne by the Office of Special Events for the food, and whatever was left over, we took profits. But we had originally asked for money, say, for our SBA. From our SBA, we simply went to the SBA and said, hey, we didn't actually need the money. We had Office of Special Events to take the costs. It depends on whatever arrangement you make with that office. You can do it either way. There's always a budget process that each SBA has set up for
okay.
it.
Because, like, Hofstra, we only get $250 to start. And,
oh, wow, okay.
The other thing I wanted to say, though, was that how we kind of went to go get money is that we went to the University Senate, the Undergraduate Senate,
mm-hmm.
and said, like, you know, we pay student activity fees, too, so fork over some cash.
Hmm.
So that's, like, and it seemed to work really well because, like, they might try to screw you over, but, like, they don't realize that they're dealing with people who aren't
dumb.
Yeah. And, like, we literally had
a... We didn't just say that.
Like, no. Because like, I'm on SBA, and we literally had the entire SBA go down there and go look.
Nice.
We pay you money, you give us back. And they owe us about $30,000. So you can probably, like...
John?
Finagle some money.
Yeah. You want more money?
No. So
oh, good.
You did not just mention that.
We didn't mention his name either. The CLE thing, where's it going? To sit? That's, first of all, that's an awesome idea. We don't really have that close of a relationship with the University
Center.
Yeah.
We don't
No, well, neither do we. That's a really cool idea. Oh, the thing about to follow up on one thing he said, when you do give it to special events, first of all, every school, whether you're aware of it or not, has an Office of Continuing Legal Education. It might be called Special Bench. It might be called something else, except for the Canada, because they don't have CLE, I don't think. Every school in America does, because they're the only people that can give CLE. And, you know, it's never left up to the ABA. It's never left up to anybody else. The way the ABA CLE system is set up is that the schools are basically given the right to assign ABA credit, or to assign CLE credit, and they do it very conscientiously because the ABA can review that, and if they find out that it was, you know, fraudulent or just stupid, you know, you don't get punished, the school gets punished. And so, and they're happy to do everything. We actually made the mistake last year. We didn't realize that this was the case, and so we handled registration ourselves, and you don't want to do that, because when I say we handled it ourselves, we handled it ourselves for like 80, 90 people, something like that. Yeah. But also, CLE is a great fundraiser. You know, bake sales and Halloween grams and everything are great, but, you know, $50 a head is what we charge for our CLE events, and that's still about $150 a head cheaper than the next cheapest one in any vaguely related field. And so you'll feel the ethical issues one wasn't so popular because it was boring. But, yeah, I mean, CLE was how we made half of the money for Eminent. So,
sorry, can you explain a little bit what you're talking about, like CLE events and so forth?
You want to do it?
What do you? I guess. What do you mean? What's your question?
I don't know what CLE is.
Every lawyer has to follow up once you graduate.
It's
a certain
state.
Well, every state has their own requirements. I believe every state still has CLE requirements.
No, Maryland.
Maryland is okay. Most states have CLE requirements, continuing legal education requirements. You have to go to get X number of credits for both general and EPIC's CLE credits each year. And you can get it from conferences, conventions, all these different things that will offer the CLE credits. And well, we're the first ones ever to do podcasts in CLE.
So you're allowing, like, NSLF events to count towards those credits? That's
absolutely. If you can coordinate it with your Office of Continuing Legal Education, absolutely. We support the idea wholeheartedly. I mean, it might be a little extra work because to make it a CLE credit event, you have to provide, all the attendees have to get a certain amount of paperwork. which can be fun getting from speakers. It can be an essay that they usually say maybe like 2,000 words. That can be an original publication they've already written. It can be the relevant case law. Anything, basically materials that your Office of Continuing Legal Education can provide to the attendees will satisfy the ABA requirements. But it's a great thing for marketing to professionals because, like Kelly said, we offer it at a dirt cheap rate compared to anything else these guys are going. These guys and ladies are going to. They're paying $200, $250 to go to events. We're saying $50. That's all we need.
And thank you. I'm sorry.
You think that would pick up on the podcast?
Yes. Hate move to strike that comment. CLE. No, I'm distracted. I'll get back. Oh yes. On the CLE thing. Not only is it cheap, but the cool thing about NSLS event is that government lawyers have to get CLE too in most states. And most CLE events are really pointless for government lawyers, but they will find an interest in things that y'all would do if it at all involves the government, which it's kind of hard not to. So, you know, that's almost a guaranteed market wherever you are, because, you know, state government still has to do it, too.
Yeah. I'll follow up, especially for government lawyers, for the event we had just put on. There was at least a good 4 or 5 attendees who were asking questions who, when they said, you know, can you please identify yourself, they go, yeah, I'm a lawyer for the federal government. And they go, can you be more specific? They go, no. You never know who you're going to get at these events. That may be just D.C. There are, of course, branch offices elsewhere in the country for various agencies, but you will get a various host of individuals who will show up to these.
A rule of thumb, by the way, when y'all have government lawyers like that, look at what they write on the name tag. Because, first of all, the people who come to your CLEs, you want to get a business card from every single one of them, because those are your next speakers for an event, or links to speakers. Towards that end, if it says United States federal government, it's generally CIA. If it says Department of Defense, it's NSA. Nobody from DIA ever comes, at least not to ours. Homeland Security, they're proud about it. FBI is proud about it. On events that you're televising or recording, this is something we ran into and it almost forestalled us airing the imminent proceedings. Or the imminent seminar, was make sure you post something outside the door saying this will be recorded. And find a place where you tell the people filming it, if it's C-SPAN or even your own recorders, you know, never put the camera over there. Because a lot of people, while they're happy to come, don't want to be seen coming by the general public. And so we had a lot of lawyers from the FBI last year, for instance, who, you know, we made sit in one corner because they said, we don't want our faces to be on TV. So make sure you air that or else you're going to get kind of blindsided the way we were by someone saying, no one said this was being recorded. And that's just kind of a safe bet.
I just want to add something to that. This is not even just for CLE in general. This is for events in general. If you're getting practitioners from the federal government, make sure you're aware of how much they are willing to be publicized in advance. A lot of them have restrictions, like you can say like they are a lawyer from the DOJ, but that's all they want on like your flyers. And they might even not want their name down on it. They're very particular about this. So be clear on what you're allowed to say about who's going to be speaking, or you might end up really irritating some people. So they might not want their name, they might not want their division, they might just want you to say they're a federal government lawyer. And this is really key because if it gets out that your chapter is not following whatever strictures they have, people are not going to want to speak because they're going to be afraid that you're going to blow whatever low level of publicity they have that they want to keep.
Actually, thanks for mentioning that because it reminded me of something. Also, with some of these speakers, you want to make sure what their requirements are in terms of for its background purposes, in terms of how much this can be podcast or broadcast, if they have restrictions on if it can be. They may say, "This can't. I'm not speaking as a government official. I'm speaking purely background purposes. They may have those restrictions, and if so, you have to abide by them, but make sure you have that in advance so you don't run into the issue the day of the event and go, oh, that's a problem.
Yeah, and for those of y'all who aren't from D.C., when you have press, the term you want to use if it's off the record, if not off the record, it's for background information only. And what that means is the press are bound by this code, because if someone comes to an event and then like attributes it to someone after they've been told it was for background information only, you know, they don't get to go any more press conferences. They get burned. So, and the press respects this. If you have an event and, you know, you have a lawyer, like GW had two lawyers a couple weeks ago that I just heard of this when they said, the lawyer from the DOJ, and I said, well, can you let me know when you find out? I said, oh, yeah, we know who it is, but, you know, we're not telling anybody. Tell the press, if a member of the press comes, this is for background purposes only, non-attributable. That's the language that the press respects, and that's the language they understand. And if you tell the agent that, the speaker that, they'll often, because they know it's also a covenant to them, be a lot more candid. And so you don't always want things to be attributable. We got some of our greatest speakers to come, well, not for imminent, because it was obviously aired, but for the more local events, to come because, you know, they were candid. They were talking about, you know, how the federal government screwed up. And they were current, you know, high officials in the government. But, you know, it was candid because it couldn't come back to hurt them.
Krieger and Zaid? No.
I don't know. Speaker of yours.
Yeah, Mark Zaid.
Mark Zaid?
Yeah.
And he's actually, I'm not going to say that because that's not public knowledge yet. There are a couple of law firms like that. There's one in Annapolis that's an independent practitioner. If you go to nationalsecuritylawyer.com, that's his firm. Krieger and Zaid in D.C. Mark Zaid was a speaker at Eminent, and he hired him. There's another law firm. If you type in National Security Law Security Clearance in Google, you'll find another law firm whose name I forget that's in D.C. as well. There's only a few of them because you have to have, you know, a clearance in order to, you know, go talk to the cleared people. But they're out there. And, you know, and the lawyers love publicity. So, you know, you might be able to, if you have the funds to pay them to, you know, fly out to Cleveland, I had to think of where your school was, then, you know, they'll probably take up. Well, Mark Zaid won't, because he barely has time to drive across town to us. But, you know, they'll take off and, you know, come and moot an argument. That's something we haven't done yet. Some lawyers, some of the best events that I've seen that NSLF didn't do, that other groups did, if you have a lawyer who's, like, involved in a high-level case or even a low-level case, sometimes you can convince them to come and, you know, moot their argument, moot their closing statement to a group. And they like it because they get feedback on what their argument's going to be, and I went to one where the lawyer actually said, you know, one of the students made such a good point that I went back and changed my argument before I went to court. And, you know, it's good for them, it's good for you, it's pretty good all around, and everybody's happy.
I don't know if you've already done this or if you're thinking about doing it, but maybe making like a posting or listing of speakers that you've had or contacts so that maybe you can kind of go around with
that. I don't want to be the only one talking about them. I'm the only one that has done this stuff. We're actually going to do that. No, we have a database that we're right now. It's on his palm, but once the other chapters start like really contributing, we're going to make it not a requirement, but you know, a request of every chapter to do what we do, and I think GW does it as well. which is whenever you have a speaker, whenever a speaker comes to speak, when you go up at the end, you say, thank you very much, I'm glad you came. Would you mind if we gave your name to people who are interested in this field? And most of them will say yes, except for the ones that say, yes, you can give the name unnamed lawyer from the Department of Justice. We're going to keep a database. We're not going to make it public access. What we're going to do, because that would be too much publicity for some of these people, especially the ones in the intelligence agencies. What we are going to do, though, once we actually have, you know, your dues come in and we can actually afford to, like, get an executive director, is say, you know, you email us and say, we're looking for somebody in this field. And he or she will go through the database and find, oh, okay, here's a couple names. Go crazy. Do whatever you want.
Another question. Okay. We only get $250. So in the Constitution, it says something about $100 to you. Now, if we have to give you $100, that leaves us $150, and that will barely cover pizza for our meetings, which by our faculty advisor was mandatory.
That's still in the draft Constitution.
Okay.
That's part of the whole debate
right,
coming
the other
up.
The thing
with
I wanted to bring up about that, and I don't know if we're going to debate this later, is there's something in the Constitution about not allowing dues from members.
Right.
And $10 from a person would be really nice.
Where I refer you to the constitutional debate in 2 hours.
Okay.
we really don't want to blur the lines here. And, I mean, I'll say, for the record, we need some kind of dues. There's also
in the Constitution, if you read it, an exception. Maybe if you didn't get the third draft, if you only read the second draft, you didn't see it. It was something that I put in after he yelled at me. was, you know, for anything here, you know, you can get an exemption from the International Executive Committee. So if you say, you know, we only got $250, then we might say, okay, can you have dues? Or maybe 25, or maybe you get exempted, especially if you're like Hofstra, and they only have $250 the first year. We say, okay, well, pay us next year.
Double next year.
No, I mean, they'll pay us $200 next year.
Yeah.
With interest.
Yeah.
Because
better, we only get $200 a year, and that's $200 Canadian.
Yeah. Yeah. There will be schools, like, especially the smaller schools. Not that you're small, but.
John, can you take these other SBAs and, you know, give them to get some money?
Will you have printed copies of the current draft?
Yes. We're while y'all are enjoying your sandwiches, we're gonna run upstairs, which it's about time for them arena to go get them. We're gonna go, I think not even upstairs, across there and print up like 20 copies, however many we have, so that y'all can read them while you eat, because when we start the debate, we actually want people to have already read it so that they're not trying to find the language that people are talking about. Also, it's my experience in the FBA that I'm guilty of sometimes too, is that occasionally you'll get someone who'll start fighting against an idea and they'll go on for like 5 minutes and then you say, read the next paragraph, and it's already there. So y'all can skim it. It's like 22 pages, so you might want to read relatively quickly.
This might actually seem like a strange concern coming from you guys who have had now a year or so of experience with this organization.
A question for you?
Okay, a question for you. One of the concerns that was expressed to me, mostly from 1Ls who haven't had any experience with national security law, don't know anything about it from a legal perspective at all,
mm-hmm.
just coming out of college in a time period where everyone's focused on the war, war on terrorism, war in Iraq, and so forth. How do you begin an organization like right off the bat without people assuming that it's going to become like a political debate or a war debate, stuff like that? Because that's what a lot of people, when I was first asking for people who are interested, they're like, oh, like we're going to talk about the war in Iraq. No, Homeland Security, not necessarily. Like it's a lot of different things. How do you go about marketing that?
Yeah. I'm going to say one small thing, and then Josh, this is a perfect question for him. It's the National Security and Law Society. We have had so many fights over that word. But when they said it. We had this fight here. People, you know, wouldn't come to our events for like a year. Actually, some of them still don't come to our events because our loyal members, like Mr. Fury, will go and say, "Hey, we're having an event today," to his neighbors, and the guy sitting next to him will say, "Yeah, but I'm against the war. I don't want to talk about that." And it can be an event on, environmental security. People are, especially law students, are often very polarized. And that's kind of one of the reasons, this grew into a longer comment than I thought, it's one of the reasons that we do exist. That's why, fostering awareness. That's why we try and have primers. Say, the people who don't know anything about it, say, we want you to join so that you'll be better educated and you'll know more so that when you decide to go, protest in front of the White House or something, or, go join ACLU, there'll be one more thing you can talk about and you'll be able to cite specifics and you'll be educated and people will respect your arguments.
I think to finish answering your question, that's why it's important to get involved with some other organizations at your school. For example, we really didn't want to only have the Federal Society as co-sponsor because they might agree with the war more often than ACS, for example. And so we got both involved. We also have events where we have ACLU speaker and a speaker who is kind of at the same level debating. And I think those are important to advertise those, which will make it more interesting and people be able to see that, yeah, it is an actual debate or a discussion on those issues from both sides.
Yeah, and I would say, to go along with that and let Brian also say something, especially on the idea of debates, yeah, you want for panel discussions, things along those lines, you want point, counterpoint. You want, if you can't, you don't have to, but I'm saying if the interest of the nonpartisan manner, in interest to get interest from your students, you want both sides of this going at each other. It makes for great entertainment and great show business. It gets on C-SPAN, but it's also very informed because you get both sides. If you just have a one-side love fest, everybody's going to walk away who didn't want to really see that is going to be ticked off about it, and you only get one side of the information. You may disagree with the other person, but at least now you know what the other side of it is. So, yeah, that was just to add to that. Brian, did you have?
Yeah, I'll just finish up by saying the way, I don't know how it works at your school, but at the very beginning of the fall, there's a general group fair where everyone advertises. So we were starting up, so we just got chartered, and so we had no membership. At our booth, we had a flyer, and on the flyer, we actually said everything we wanted to do during the year, so people could see it wasn't just about Iraq, it wasn't just about patriotic whatever. And we actually said, look, we're going to have a cybercrimes thing, we're going to have a contractors panel, we're going to have a free speech panel. One of the things we want to do in the spring is discuss free speech rights versus inciting to terrorism with the recent cases of clerics being arrested and whatnot. So show that it's not just about partisan issues, and it actually is more concerned with legal issues, and so that people can see off the bat, this is what we're going to be doing. So even if you don't have any of the panel, we didn't have any of the panels set up, we were just saying this is what we want to do. And it got people realizing that it's a broader spectrum than simply a partisan group.
Really quickly on the point-counterpoint issue, not every event has to be a debate. And I would actually add, and this is kind of where Brad and I have had backroom fights over this, the point-counterpoint can be over two different events. For some events, you only want one speaker, especially like a keynote event or something like that. Just remember that, encourage those people who would be kind of offended by that, we could only have one speaker. But, if you have, Governor Gilmore, who we had, make the next keynote speaker, someone maybe from the other side, your practitioner's dinner, go across the spectrum, so that over the scope of 1 or 2 years, they see that this is a nonpartisan society. Same on that. It's really difficult, but if you do sponsor something with a perceived partisan organization like Federalist Society, just make sure you sponsor another event with the other side, and so you may get only one shot at the event. But I mean, we did that kind of non-politically. We did it, you know, socially, politically by co-sponsoring one event with Phi Alpha Delta Legal Fraternity, and then co-sponsoring another one with Phi Delta Phi. But you can do things like, you know, if you got, you know, Suzanne Spaulding, who was John Kerry's the head of intelligence on his campaign, you got her speaking, then, you know, go and co-sponsor it with the WCL Democrats, but make sure you do something with the Republicans next time. That WCL is this school, but, you know, whatever, Young Democrats. So that's really up to your, if you want, it's a fine line. You have to be really careful you don't cross it, but, you know, you can dance on it for greater attendance, because, you know, those groups, they're partisan, but they're freaking huge. And because everyone's a Democrat or Republican. And so, well, most of them. And so you get membership, and most of them are moderate. So most of them may come to your other events that are maybe on the other side a little bit.
One other thing. Something we had thought of, we've done it in the context of some other organizations, but in general, instead of just having speakers come in, something that's been successful is having actual student debates, coming up with just random topics that a lot of students are very passionate about, and they'll offer to do some research and put the time in necessary, and then like maybe have someone from the National Security and Law Society moderate something like that. Have you ever done anything like that?
We haven't, but I very much like the idea.
The Democrats did it.
We didn't do it. There was a debate similar to that at the school.
Yeah, there was a WCO Democrat. It was just the Democrats that hosted that thing last year, right? And they, I think they were just debating generic, it was right before the presidential election, and they were debating, you know, the Democratic position versus the Republican position. And it got a huge following, ran into some problems, which if you're going to do something like that, make sure that you don't run afoul of your SBA's finance guidelines. Because like ours, you have to have an outside speaker or else you don't get any money for food. So if it's only a student event, yeah, it's a brown bag. And if it's something cool, then people will come to it. Just don't do it at lunch when they need food. But yeah, that sounds like a very cool idea. And even I think that would actually be a corollary into, you know, their project is, you know, if you can get a bunch of students to debate it, you know, once they're done with the debate, have them take it to the blog. And then that involves other people, and, you know, their names get out beyond the school. People across the country read their names and say, hey, that's interesting.
Hi, I'm Dan Rakowski from Nova Southeastern University in Orlando, Florida. And I just wanted to comment on one of the last couple questions about the nonpartisanship of the organization and getting that message out. First of all, we had to, like, throw a pitch to our faculty to get them to approve before we even approach the SBA, which I assume is the case in most places. But it got me...
Not for us, but
no, we had to attend a faculty meeting and speak and basically get their approval. And getting ready to do that little speech was very educational for me, because I had to really gather my thoughts as to, well, what, you know, what is the organization really, and what is its purpose, and how do I sell that to a law school faculty? And it got me very focused on just how expansive the field is, just how many issues could be covered. Just like you said earlier, the scope is very broad. And if you could somehow mold that into a short statement that you could use over and over again, like, for instance, our school is heavily dependent on email communication. We have an evening program also. In fact, Maria and I are both in the evening program. So communication on email is paramount to the organization's communicating with the student body and faculty at our school. And if that, I don't want to say tagline, but if you could get that short mission statement, for lack of a better term, on all of your communications, on your flyers, or however you use to communicate those events, that would reinforce in everyone's mind that you're not a partisan organization. This isn't about the war in Iraq. This is about the very broad and expansive field of legal issues that they pertain to national security. And I think that recommendation would probably help out in that area. We have a very liberal school, as I would assume most law schools are. I don't know about the ones here in D.C., but
there's,
and even if you were to think, oh, let's, you know, let's play to that side of the fence, I think that kind of takes away from the purpose of the organization. So I'm glad that y'all are very concerned with the nonpartisanship aspect of things, and that I would hope everyone tries to keep it that way, regardless of who their what their name for their school is.
That statement actually is sort of out there. Right before Eminent, our wonderful, generous editors committee drafted a one-page, basically, press kit for NSLS, and a version, a slightly modified version of that is actually on the WCL NSLS webpage and the national webpage, and you know. Nonpartisan. I mentioned nonpartisan like three times, something like that. And we always, the other thing to say when you're pitching things orally, you can't pitch them verbally. You can't pitch them in writing as much. But when you're pitching it orally, it's all about the selection of your executive committee or your governing body. We joke. We're the co-founders, Republican, Democrat. The president and vice president this year are, you know, Jew-Palestinian. And so it's make a point of saying, you know, in the... now you've screwed me up. Make sure that the XCOM is balanced. Or try. I mean, you can't. It is an election, but you know, try and come as close as you can to having different people, because you know, if you don't have, you know, two sides of an issue on the XCOM, you're going to have less likelihood of getting, you know, truly nonpartisan issues, and really debates on, you know, what should happen, what should not, and that's served us well.
And just to supplement that, because all of you are basically the initiators of your chapters. In your second or your third year, your final year there, when you're starting, you're molding whoever's going to take your place to make sure this whole thing continues. Keep that in mind when you're looking for who you want to mold and make them into the potential candidates to replace you. Is that try to keep this balance in mind of what you've already established.
Mold very carefully. We're not kingmakers, so
efficient.
Now on that, as kind of a leadership note in general, you won't, the NSLS, because it is so complicated, because the field is so complicated, because it is so controversial, and because a lot of the things we do end up ultimately mired in the school bureaucracy, you want to generally get an idea around January of who is interested in being the next XCOM elected in April. Because those people, you know, if there's four people wanting to be president, that's fine. But you start involving them in the decisions and in the logistics so that you don't have to fight the same battles over and over and over again with the administration. Because the administration never changes. I love you, Dean Grossman, but wherever you're listening to this. The several administrations... And we're kind of lucky in this, but I've seen other schools go through problems, and we went through it once. Because there's like 50 groups here, and you know, however many independent interests. If you know, we hammer out a deal with the Office of Generic Affairs, then the next year comes around and the people don't know the specifics of the deal, the people in the office, in the administration, the bureaucrats, may have completely forgotten it. And so you might have to hammer out the whole deal again, and you might end up with a different deal. Whereas if you can say, look, you know, last year we did this and this and this and this and this, it has continuity and it increases efficiency, because every year you're constantly adjusting for what you did wrong the last year.
I probably another version of having a debate and bringing various views to a subject, but we had a simulation, and I think this is one of a kind in the nation, and the second time we've had it, or our school had one for the class. But we went to the offices of Jones Day, and we had they had already arranged the whole script, and we got in groups of like four or five people, and we were issued a topic. Like mine was targeted killing, and some other people had FISA, some other people had the Patriot Act, and so it pretty much started with like a drug ring in. I'll just give you a little background, but it started with a drug ring in the United States that was funneling money to Al-Qaeda in the Middle East. And so, I mean, our professors got really creative with it, but pretty much we had to present our topic and then go back and do the simulation, and they would just give us a role and give us some facts on the role, and then we had to debate it. And so we had one where we had, like, ACLU representative and, excuse me, and then someone would be a judge. And so you'd have to appeal to the judge, like the DEA would have to appeal to the judge to get wiretapping laws or something through FISA, right? And it was just really interesting, really pertinent to what's going on, and it was like a 5-hour deal one afternoon. And I was thinking that this would be a great event for members of, like you set something up for members of National Security and Law Society, and then have an audience watch it and see how it kind of develops. An afternoon and kind of do that to replace like a CLE event, which also takes 5 hours. And this way you get students involved in learning specific topics.
That's a really great idea. It sounds similar to something that, I'm not getting any credit for pitching this, but something y'all might want to look into is something called the National Security Decision-Making Game. And it generally happens around four times a year. It's run out of the Lexington Park, Maryland. The guy that runs it, his name is Dan McDonough. NFDMG.com. And what it is for 5 to 8 hours, everyone who participates, it generally goes to, role-playing game and anime and sci-fi and fantasy cons and stuff like that. But they have, 40 to 80 people participating, and each person gets a role as, through, two or three countries, the head of the CIA, the head of Chinese Interior Intelligence, the members of Congress, economic minister, something like this, where you're playing the head roles of government figures, and then you have to play through this scenario that they throw at you. A bomb just went off in Beijing, and every now and then they'll throw in random stuff to keep the game interesting. But if you look at the scripts of these games, I've been in several of them. I actually helped run one of them. The script for the game is like 5 bullets. And yet the game is insane because, it's all based on what the people do. One of the games, we had one called Buffy the President Slayer, so the Hamas leader managed to pull off an assassination of the president, completely screwed up all the other 4 bullet points, and we had to wing it for the next, 4 hours. But it's really great in creative thinking, but thinking the way governments do, because they have bureaucratic, each year, you have to do it a year each hour, the Congress debates the budget, and you have everyone in, at least the U.S. cell, but each one has a goal, and the goals are mutually exclusive. The intelligence wants to get more money away from defense wants to get more money away from intelligence. Transportation wants to take money away from everyone, and it really works out neatly. That thing, I'd like that as a more legal version of this, and I would love it if you would, post more details of that to the XCOM group so that other people could look at it and see if other chapters might get it started. It might become a similar thing if it works that well. It'll be a model that we, print out the guidelines and copyright it and give it to schools.
Yeah, I think it'd be exciting because it'll bring in more membership if they know that they get to participate. also learn a lot about a specific topic and, you know, general information about other topics, but it's also fun, I think, as an audience, because for most of the day I was just audience, and I was speculating on what was going to happen. Obviously, targeted killings was at the very end, and we had to make a decision with the president to take out a potential assassin. And, you know, there's so many implications in that. You know, are we in armed conflict and blah, 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 and are we allowed to do that kind of stuff? So, like, the whole time I'm speculating on who are we going to kill? Are we going to have to do target killing in the United States? And is that constitutional? And or are we going to do the Middle East? And then it kind of developed so that it was in the Middle East and it was not a U.S.
Right, we send them to Russia.
But, like, the whole time you just kind of are on the edge of your seat because you kind of want to see it develop, and no one really knows where it's going until the very end. So it could be fun for an audience, too.
Brian, do you want to talk about the moot court thing coming up in the spring? No. GW is really cool. GW has a National Security Law moot court event in the spring. That, yes, do you want to talk about that? Do you know about that?
Yeah. It's not GW's affair. It's just been, as far as I know, it's being hosted at GW. And so we don't actually have control over it. And in fact, I'm pretty sure it's the moot court board at GW that will be in charge of vetting teams and whatnot. So we don't really have that much information on it, and I'm not even sure how much control we have over it, because it's not a GW law event. It's just being, as far as I know, it's just being hosted at GW.
I don't know. Speaking on that issue of moot court, we actually have had many, many, many long debates in the SBA about this, which y'all probably run into as well. You know, generally, as a matter of professional deference and respect, if you see an event that, you know, you think that they would be, that you would, your members would be interested in going to a moot court competition for, like, you know, I'm assuming it's going to be hosted this year, it's generally hosted every 2 years at GW, you know, go to your moot court board and say, do y'all want to send a team? If they say no, then if you can go to the SBA and prove that, you know, you have people, you have an advisor who'd be willing to oversee your team, sometimes they'll let, you know, let you send a team. And, like, we're going to be off the record right now trying to get an NSLS team to go to this competition because the moot court board, I don't even think, knows about it because it only happens every 2 years. I found it by accident when we were first setting up NSLS. And sometimes we have a couple chapters. I think GW is trying to, y'all's chapter is trying to set it up so that an NSLS chapter, an NSLS team and a moot court team are competing, aren't you? Something like that?
No, the issue whether or not, it's really convoluted how it works. And I think if the moot court board picks a team, that's a team, but they might not be picking a team. I can't really, I have nothing to talk about in terms of that right now.
Most schools, and John, if he wanted to talk, which he doesn't because he's studying. I love John. Most schools have very stringent requirements for that, though. So before you even approach the competition, you know, go to the moot court board, go to the SBA, you may have to jump through hoops that take months to jump through in order to even get to the point where you can approach the competition about, you know, asking permission to attend. But once you do, you know, if you get to send a team, then, you know, if, Case is a bad example because y'all have a center for security law coming up. If Hofstra, you know, your moot court board have no interest in this, it still looks good if Hofstra is, you know, on the list of competitors, especially if you win. And once you win, you may lose control of it, kind of a la the career fair. If you win, you know, your moot court board may decide to send a team next year, but, you know, so what? You're sending a team, and you get on moot court, perhaps, because, you know, you're not a member of moot court, but you go and compete, and you come in second. That's going to look pretty good when you're trying to get on moot court next year, because all the law firms won't move court. That's, of course, completely my personal opinion and not the opinion of anyone.
not even me.
Other questions? When you guys were first starting out, what type of events garnered more attention, and what events did you guys think that you could have done without, or is there anything that was kind of like a surprise that you guys thought that you guys ran that was more successful, or
we haven't had an event quite yet. No. So.
Yeah, students like seeing outside panels. That's the big draw.
As opposed to like, do you think like in terms of like a debate or versus like a speaker versus like a moderator, or what do you think is probably the?
I think the format is less important than whether or not you can get an outside speaker. I think that's if your poster says you have someone from X agency, that's what's going to draw people to come talk, because they want to see someone from the field speaking. Whether it's a debate between two or it's just a keynote speaker, is less important than demonstrating that you have the ability to bring speakers to the school. And that's what's going to get people interested.
Right. And that's just the add to that, not just the fact that it's an outside speaker, but the name recognition. If you get someone who's high profile or someone who is something very controversial, for instance,
John Yu.
Yeah, for John Yu, for that event, or for the event we just had with Ethical Issues for Government Lawyers, we had Jessalyn Raddick, who was the DOJ attorney who blew the whistle on the John Walker Lynn situation. We also had Judge Webster, who used to be the head of both CIA and FBI. The bigger names you can pull off, obviously, the more draw you're going to get. But, yeah, I mean, again, I definitely agree with that. It's more the issue of who you're getting than simply the format.
If you're going to have a panel and you're going after big names, be very careful, though, because you may end up shooting yourself in the foot if you get one panelist who's really super cool, and I'm showing my age right there, and no other panelists will want to do it because of the intense power differential. You're not going to junior assistant to the deputy secretary or something is not going to go up against the assistant attorney general or something. We actually almost ran into that problem once with one of our panels, and the only way that we got around it was, I'll back up a step. There are two real types. If you have a panel discussion, there are two ways to divide them up. Either that you have an issue, and then you have someone, for a side, against your side, and then the academics, because the academics are always kind of out in left field. Or you have a topically diverse panel. We had a panel called Efforts to Combat Transnational Trafficking in Arms, Drugs, and Humans. And we had one person talking about humans, another person talking about arms, another person talking about drugs. And that was the one where we had the power differential because one of them was an assistant attorney general. But we got the others to come because they weren't going to be going point counterpoint with the senior person. They were going to be talking on something that they presumably knew more about than them, and so they were going to be the person who always answered the questions on the other issue, so they wouldn't either look bad or make the other person look bad. Couple more questions, and then the food gets here, and we'll give you the Constitution.
I just had another question, actually. At Hofstra on Monday, I'm going to go argue a petition in front of my student bar about why we should have this organization on campus. And one of the things they're looking for is it's not a doctrinal field of law, national security. And I kind of have to argue why it should be an organization, even though it's not a doctrinal field of law. Do you guys have any ideas with that, or have you run into that before?
We haven't, but we foresaw this, or I foresaw this, and I'm so modest. I got 3 points for you. Number one, that's complete BS. There's a textbook written by John Norton Moore, another textbook written by Steve Dykus called National Security Law. They sell for like $300 a piece.
Yeah. And Duke has, I think they have an actual class called National Security and Law.
That's the second point, is classes are being springing up everywhere.
Right.
As a side note to that, there is a Center for National Security Law at UVA. There's a Center for Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke. There's a journal called Journal of National Security Law and Policy out of McGeorge. There's, you know, all these centers out there. Three, one of the, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to rephrase my, because I was about to give a whole lot of credit that would be sort of false. It'd be more propaganda. Both the AALS and the ABA have committees. The ABA has a standing committee on law and national security. The AALS has a national security law committee. There are national security law subcommittees in 6 or 7 of the ABA sections. And the AALS is actually looking to adopt a model for national student law, national security law student organization. We're hoping that that model will be us. We're actually in the middle of talking to them about that. But, you know, one of their big things is we want students to learn about national security law. The director of that section actually was the panelist on last week's panel. And on that, I think I'm done on that.
I think they kind of have the idea that it should be part of, like, the International Law Society or part of another, like, the American Constitution Society. And I kind of try to get across the idea that we're dealing with different things. This is not International Law Society. It's kind of deals with a broad international scope. This is kind of more American foreign policy orientated. And I'm going to go debate that on Monday, actually. But that's basically my arguing points are it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have a list of reasons why. But I don't know if you guys have any other.
Well, to some extent, national security law is to some degree a combination of international law and constitutional law, obviously. But it's distinct. One, in fact, that as you mentioned, international law is it's not that it's necessarily U.S. oriented, because it can be any nation's national law. It's not private oriented. International law is much more concerned with private parties and private claims and private transactions. When it deals with governments, that's national security law. I'm a member of the International Law Society at GW, and we don't discuss anything I'm really interested in at all. International law is societies mainly are focused on private practice. They're not concerned with government work. To some extent, maybe like the State Department, but if you're interested in any of the securities field, which are government agencies are some of the largest employers of lawyers in the public sector, they're not going to like deal with the International Law Society. They're going to deal with the National Security Law Society. Constitutional Law Society, it's way broader than anything you're interested in. It deals with everything under the spectrum of the Constitution. So it's not, it's a combination of the two, but it's much more focused, and it really, the overlap is minimal because the goal of the society is completely different than the goals of the other two. I don't really think that you should have a problem being able to delineate that and distinguish that.
Just as, I don't have anything topical to add, just as an additional selling point, something we got this morning. We have, you know, you can say that, you know, NSLS has the blessing and you can't use the word endorsement, but you can say the blessing and strong support of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. And that counts for a lot. And, you know, it's not a formal endorsement. We don't have like a stamp, you know, the favorite law student of the organization. But, you know, that's something. It means that we've proven ourselves. Similarly, if you want something for a written thing, email me. We have like 3 or 4 official endorsements from people in the field. You know, Joe Whitley, the former general counsel of DHS, we have a little one-paragraph thing from him talking about how great the National Security Law Society is. We got one from Suzanne Spaulding, the former general counsel of the
She was general counsel of
the deputy general counsel of the House Permanent Select Committee. Oh, Senate. No, House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and TIA and everything. She's done like four things. And we can say, you know, here, use this quote. And we have like four or five of those quotes that we can give you of people who say, these are good people. You need to help them, be proud of them and help them.
Next. Are there any others?
All righty then. In that case, there's food here. I want to thank you all for coming to this panel. Thank those of you who are listening. For those of you who are listening, actually, you know where our website is because you're listening. So all of the panelists, thank you very much. And I'm going to go across the hall and print up the constitutions, get your food, and when I get back in like 5 minutes, I'm going to give you all copies. I'd like you to, you know, read them over so that we can start around 1 o'clock and get the debate going as smoothly as possible so that we don't stay here and run over and be hurried before we go to dinner. We give our panelists a round of applause and...